This September, KPP Concerts presents a stacked lineup of shows at the Broom Factory featuring everything from big-name acts to local gems. On September 12th, check out punk legends DOA with opening sets by The Meringues and Owl Farm. On September 13th, Kingston's own Oak Ridge Avenue hits the stage with Ottawa Rockers, The New Hires. On September 14th, pop-punk and emo cover band Strike Tyson will play alongside local acts Sonic Souvenir and Squid Pistol. September 15th, folk singer Katie Tupper will play a matinee with Kingston's own Luella opening the show. On September 16th, punk heavyweights Authority Zero and Belvedere with special guests Melon Ball are performing. On September 18th, the legendary Martha Wainwright plays live in Kingston. On September 20th, local rockers Cassador return to the Broom Factory with Sparrow Blue. On September 21st, Nova Scotia's Mo Kenny will play a show. And on September 28th, don't miss Virginia to Vegas with special guest Alex Porat. For more information and to buy tickets, visit kppconcerts.com.
Good evening, it is 5 p.m. and this is Today in YGK on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. Today in YGK is brought to you by CFRC's News Collective, Christina Laurie, Jesse Bell, Lauren Tucker, Dinah Jansen, and Paige Lang. CFRC's news programming is made possible by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and the Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. A recent study led by researchers from Kingston Health Sciences Center, the Kingston General Health Research Institute, and Queen's University has uncovered some of the factors contributing to the rising demand for pediatric urgent care in the Kingston area. The research, led by Dr. Daniel Mulder, a pediatrician at KHSC and assistant professor at Queen's, used urgent care data from KHSC's Children's Outpatient Clinic, tracking pediatric urgent care visits from 2006 to 2022. Since the mid-2010s, there has been a significant increase in demand for pediatric urgent care, putting added pressure on health teams. To provide us with deeper insights into the surge in urgent care visits and what they mean for our health system, CFRC was joined by Dr. Mulder. Here is a bit of our conversation. Your research was to get to the bottom of the increase in demand for pediatric urgent care. What was the scale of this increase in demand, and how did it contribute to the pressures on our health system that we've been seeing over the last few years?
Yeah, so we were worried because we're seeing more and more demand for urgent care for children here in Kingston. And we were really concerned that, you know, this was a multifactorial problem. We were suspicious that there were a few specific issues driving this. So we looked at the data over the past, you know, decade and a half and found there was quite the increase as we thought. But some of the interesting pieces that we found that were not as obvious were that visits were lasting quite a bit longer. You know, so if you do the math, you take the number of visits increasing over time, and then you add in that each visit is longer and the amount of care delivered each day is increased quite a bit. So then we said, well, what could there be that, you know, would be driving that change, and what's changing in society, you know? And we can only really analyze the data we have. And so we looked at the data, which was quite rich, and we saw that, you know, over time we were seeing more patients with infections, which isn't that obvious. I think, you know, thinking back to 2019, right? But after COVID hit and, you know, we saw lots and lots of patients with COVID, we knew that this was driving demand, but we actually see that increased demand for children with infections coming to urgent care has increased maybe probably 2017, 2018. So it actually happened before COVID that we were seeing a lot more kids with infections. We also see much more patients without a primary care provider, so without a family doctor or nurse practitioner, you know, seeing them regularly, doing healthcare check-ins, these kind of things. So these patients tend to be a bit sicker and tend to then come to need urgent care, you know, in much higher proportions when they don't have a family doctor or someone like that supporting them. And then finally, we saw that the patients had increasing complexity. So we see this as pediatricians, but, you know, people on the street may not sort of appreciate this change, is that over time, we're getting better and better at treating complicated conditions with more and more equipment. And so we're much more likely to see children with complications of feeding tubes, breathing apparatuses that they need, wheelchairs, these kind of things that are going along. And often patients have more than one piece of technology supporting their life. And so when those things stop working, they come to urgent care. And so we're seeing more of that. So these things all added together, the increase in infections, the decrease in primary care access, and the increase in complexity of the patients, to mean that visits are more frequent and they're lasting longer. And that's driving this demand. So that was very helpful, I think, to find that information out.
Yeah, for sure. And you mentioned, I think a lot of people think of this as sort of a COVID thing, but you mentioned this sort of started accelerating in the mid-2010s. I was wondering if you could speak to some of the reasoning behind that, why we were seeing more complex cases and more infections during that time period to now.
Yeah, that's a great question. So the data only tells us really what we can pull out of the urgent care visits. And so in terms of why we're seeing increased infections, this is not clear to us. And we want to look into this more because, you know, there's a few possible reasons. It could be just an increase in circulating infections in society sort of overall. It could be that, you know, we're seeing more and more patients coming to urgent care with coughs and colds because they maybe don't have a family doctor or someone to check in with, you know, so they're coming to urgent care for visits that, you know, coughs and colds that would go normally to their family doctor. They don't have a family doctor, so then they come see us, and that drives the demand as well. So that was probably happening prior to 2020 and COVID. And then the complexity issue is a challenging one because, you know, we're getting better at treating patients, which is wonderful, right? We're getting more technologies available. We're keeping patients well and out of hospital more, which is wonderful. But that means that those patients at home need care and they're complicated. And so they come to see a pediatrician at the urgent care center rather than, you know, going to their family doctor potentially or to the emergency department.
And what kind of solutions do you foresee for this kind of issue?
So, you know, this is a resource planning issue, I think, you know, and really the goal of pediatrics and healthcare in general, when it comes to children, you know, is to raise healthy kids. And this is a much better thing for everyone, not just the patient, but society in general, if we raise healthy kids rather than try to treat sick adults, you know. And so we're trying to find ways that we can help the people who, you know, distribute resources for healthcare make decisions. So, you know, we've identified these factors and we think that targeting those as early as possible would be best, right? So we're looking for ways to decrease circulating infections, ways to better support complex patients, you know, who absolutely need to see pediatricians when things go wrong, when they're not feeling well. You know, these patients need access to pediatricians and also access to primary care for most children, if not all children, right? So we think that this is probably a great way to prevent these increased burdens on urgent care centers and emergency departments, is to have primary care access to for children. And this is something that, you know, it's not news, but now we have data to support it and data from our local region to support that this need is there. And so I think these patients are going to be the best way to solve this increased demand problem.
I know you're thinking about doing more research across Ontario and perhaps across Canada. Have you seen similar studies done in other regions, or will this sort of be new in a bigger way?
Yeah, we are very lucky as Canadians to have this semi-centralized healthcare system, right? So, you know, regardless of your sort of political stance and your thoughts on where, why, and how our healthcare system should be built, we have the data from the healthcare system in a fairly centralized way. And so, you know, when I talk to other pediatric researchers in the U.S., they're very jealous of the data set we have. The system just isn't centralized there. And we think this problem of increased demand and decreased primary care access is happening all over the world. So there's data from the UK and there's data from the US, especially thus far, to support that this is an ongoing issue across the board. And there's many systemic problems with you know, healthcare resources. It's a limited pool of resources and an increasing demand over time as our population gets more complex and we are getting better at treatments and we have larger populations. And so looking at the data for Ontario, I think will be the next big step. We don't have that data yet, but it will be fairly straightforward to do this research because the structure of the data we looked at from our urgent care center is going to be the same as the data structured from other centers. And so expanding this research won't, you know, be an overnight solution that we can find, but we will be able to look at the large set of data once we get access in a fairly similar way. And so that will be helpful. And we think that we'll find the same trends across the board, because that's what we're hearing in the news. That's what we're seeing in, you know, government reports, that there's increased demand across the board, not just for children, but hopefully our expanded work will be able to show some of the factors that are doing that, you know, and making this change and driving this demand.
That was Dr. Daniel Mulder with KHSC sharing key insights from his team's recent study on the increase in pediatric urgent care demand in Kingston. For those interested in exploring the study further, you can read it in the PLOS Digital Health Journal. This has been Christina Laurie with CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative.
The Queen's Gaels tallied the 499th win in program history on Saturday with a decisive 52-19 victory over the York University Lions. The Gaels drew first blood with a 13-yard completion from Alex Vreakin to Nathan Falcone to take an early 7-0 lead. The Gaels would score again, but 4 minutes later as Silas Hubert recovered a fumble and took it back for 6 points. And at the end of the first quarter, Ian St. Arnaud with one of the rarest plays in college football, a 119-yard missed field goal return to put the Gaels up 21-0 early. Windsor would get on the board with a rouge and two safeties, making it 21-5. And right before halftime, Windsor would make it a 21-12 deficit following an Alfred Olay 36-yard touchdown. Tyler Mullen would put a field goal up at the last minute to give the Gaels a 24-12 lead heading into the second half. And the second half was all Gaels as Jared Kasari put them up 31-12 with a 3-yard touchdown run. Nathan Falcone got his second touchdown of the game from Alex Vreakin, a 15-yard pass late in the third quarter. And right at the end of the third quarter, Ian St. Arnaud, lightning struck twice as he returned his second 119-yard missed field goal return of the game to put the Gaels up 45-12. York would score late, but Queens actually got the last points of the ball game as first-year running back Jaden Gersey McDonald, on his first career carry, took it 52 yards to the end zone to give Queens the decisive 52-19 scoreline. The Gaels are in action looking for win 500 this upcoming Saturday, September 14th. They will be on the road in Ottawa to play the Gigis, and CFRC will be there live. For more information on that game, please check out the following promo. Over the last three seasons, the Queens Gaels have had the Ottawa Gigi's number. These teams have played seven times since 2021, and Queens has walked away victorious on all seven occasions. For each of the last 3 years, Ottawa's season has ended at Richardson Memorial Stadium. But with every game played, the margin of victory gets tighter and tighter. In 2023, the Gaels won their two matchups by 7 total points. On Saturday, September 14th, the two Titans of the OUA East rekindle their rivalry once more as the Gaels make the short trip up the 416 to play the Gigis in Ottawa. Will the Gaels make it an elite 8 in a row, or will the Gigis finally snap their post-pandemic losing streak? Tune in to CFRC 101.9 FM at 2:45 for the pregame show ahead of the 3 p.m. kickoff. We hope to see you then.
Thank you.
thanks so much. And now it's time for the CFRC Weekly Traffic Report. Motorists are advised that pavement rehabilitations will continue to take place along Highway 401 overnight between Westbrook Road to beyond Highway 15 overpass and on the Sir John A. McDonald overpass. This work will consist of various lane and ramp closures over the next several months. Public Services and Procurement Canada continues to advise users that the LaSalle Causeway is still fully closed to motorists, cyclists, and pedestrians until further notice. For local road closures, Albert Street from Princess to 486 Albert will be closed until December 31st to accommodate construction activity and staging. Edwin Street from Collins Bay to Waverly will be closed until September 18th for the removal and reinstatement of asphalt. Hillcrest Avenue from Kings Court to 7th is closed until August 31st for buried infrastructure replacement. The road will be open to local traffic. Kings Court Avenue from Hillcrest to Kirkpatrick is closed until November 15th to accommodate a water main replacement. King Street from Place d'Armes to the north end of King is closed until September 30th for construction of new storm and road beds, and the road will be open to local traffic. Sydenham Street from Princess to Queen is closed until September 27th for downtown Kingston BIA activations. Union Street from Victoria to Albert is currently closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. University Avenue from Union to Earl is closed for construction related to activity at the Queen's John Deutsch University Center. And Wellington Street from Earl de Gore is closed until September 10th for new water service installation. For other delays, Aberdeen Street from Johnson to Earl, folks can expect delays and closures along Aberdeen for a contractor to complete road and sewer reconstruction. Bay Ridge Drive from Princess to Taylor Kidd can expect delays while a contractor begins phase two of the Bay Ridge Drive Active Transportation Upgrades Project. Collins Bay Road from Prince Charles and Edwin to Princess, folks can expect delays while a contractor completes phase two of the Princess and Collins Bay active transportation improvements. Gardner's Road at Centennial and Creekford expect delays while a contractor completes intersection widening, traffic signal upgrades, and cycling and pedestrian improvements. And Highway 2 from Abbeydon to St. Lawrence expect delays there to complete enhanced flood protection of Abbeydon Road, Highway 2, and St. Lawrence Avenue. And continued notice of a parking disruption at the Hanson Memorial parking structure where its restoration project is now currently underway. Motorists are advised that there is parking available at the Chan Memorial and Robert Bruce Memorial parking garages in the two adjacent blocks to the west of the Hanson Memorial parking structure.
This is Jesse Bell with your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. We start to get to the warmer temperatures around midweek as Wednesday, September 11th will be a beautiful sunny day, a high of 25, dropping down to 14 overnight. Thursday, September 12th, sunny with a high of 26, dropping down to 14 overnight. Friday, September 13th, it will be 26 with a mix of sun and cloud. And moving into the weekend, Saturday, September 14th, a high of 26, and Sunday, September 15th, a high of 25 with a 30% chance of precipitation.
Thanks so much. Now it's time for the CFRC Concerts and Events calendar for this week. On Wednesday, September 11th, Toronto-based folk band Burrs will play a free show at Hotel Wolf Island from 6 to 9 p.m. On Thursday, September 12th, you can check out a big show by punk legends DOA, accompanied by local greats The Meringues and Owl Farm at the Broom Factory. The fun starts at 7:30 and admission is $25. Also on September 12th, you can catch local artist Sadie McFadden of Hinterwood at the Cove Inn for free from 5 to 8 p.m. On September 12th, you can also catch Bianda Kiera and the Oddfellows Orchestra playing jazz, blues, and calypso with a modern cabaret noir twist at Hotel Wolf Island for free. And also check out Rev Zed, Mason FM, and the Clay Pigeons for only $5 at the Mansion on September 12th from 8:30 to 11:30 p.m. On Friday, September 13th, you could go see Oak Ridge Avenue accompanied by the new hires at the Broom Factory for $20, or check out Black Mask Coven featuring Astral Witch, Vaced, and Stunseed at the Mansion starting at 7 p.m. and stick around for Motorcycle Sidecar, Heavy Head, Rust Pump, and Carnelian. Admission is $15. Frank Ryan will also play a set for free at Tear to Dog on September 13th starting at 9 p.m. and CFRC's own John McClurg takes the stage for a free acoustic set from 5 to 8 p.m. at the Toucan. On Saturday, September 14th, you can go see Strike Tyson at the Broom Factory for $20, AKPP Concerts Show starting at 7:30. Also on September 14th, the Bobsleigh Boating Accident Benefit event will take place at McKinnon Brothers Brewing in Bath starting at 4 p.m. Admission is $25. Christopher Jackson will also play a free show at Spearhead Brewery from 2 to 5 p.m., while Bon Evans will play at Tiernanog for free that evening starting at 9 p.m. And on Sunday, September 15th, you can enjoy a show by Katie Tupper with local act Luella at the Broom Factory for $20. The show starts at 2:30. Also on Sunday, you can catch a free matinee performance by Pagoda Starling at Hotel Wolf Island starting at 3 p.m. Later on that evening, Cootie Catcher and the Crime Family will also play a free show starting at 8:30 at Hotel Wolf Island. And the Cork Sniffers will also play free country, roots, folk, and bluegrass music at the Memorial Center Farmers Market starting at noon. And folks can also take the stage themselves on Sunday night from 10:30 onward at the Toucan's free weekly karaoke night with Jeremy Green. And that wraps it up for concerts. Now over to community events for this week. On Wednesday, September 11th, head over to the Rideau Heights Community Center for the Fresh Food Market Pop-Up, featuring fresh, healthy, and affordable food options from 2 to 5 p.m. Also on Tuesday, the Central Branch of the Kingston Frontenac Public Library will host Cafe Franglish, where folks can enjoy a free opportunity to practice conversation in English and French over a cup of coffee. On Wednesday night, AKA Autonomous Social Center will host Taqwa Core, The Birth of Punk Islam film screening for free from 6:30 to 8 p.m. Something in the Water Brewing and Daft Brewing will also host their trivia nights starting at 7 p.m. and One Eye Jacks will host North End Board Games Night for free starting at 7. On Thursday, September 12th, Kingston Community Health Centers will host a senior social group for folks ages 55 plus from 9:30 to 11:30 a.m. Also on Thursday, head over with your runners to Runner's Choice for the weekly Out in Front running group for 2S LGBTQ plus runners ready to run at 6:15 p.m. for 5 to 6 kilometers, followed by a post-run social. On Friday, September 13th, the YMCA will host its fresh food pop-up market featuring healthy food options that won't break the bank. And on the 13th, Skeleton Park Arts Festival will host a mystery movie screening at McBurney Park, a free family-friendly event starting at 7 p.m. At 8 p.m. at the Mansion, you can also enjoy the Cringe Night drag show hosted by Bewitched and featuring the talents of Simone Says, Josephine J, Morgan Morbid, Universe, and Annihilation. Tickets are $10 online and $15 at the door. On Saturday, September 14th, the Kingston Public Market runs from 8:30 to 4 p.m. in Springer Market Square. Also on Saturday, Daughter's General Store will host a vegan brunch takeover featuring Toronto's Sausage Party and Ottawa's Little Joe Berries from 11 to 1:30. At 3 p.m. on Saturday, the Tet Center will host a beginner's workshop on Madhubani Indian folk art. The admission is $25. Also on Saturday, St. Luke's Church will host a Scottish country dance in Cayley, a free event starting at 7 p.m. And on Sunday, September 15th, get up early and head over to Runner's Choice for an early morning log run starting at 8:30 a.m. And finally, the Memorial Center Farmers Market will take place from 9 to 2 p.m. featuring food, artisanal crafts, and music. Have a concert or event in the Kingston area that you would like us to cover on our website and news programming? Contact us today via cfrc.ca.
Thank you for tuning in to CFRC's local news programming. To revisit episodes of Today in YGK and hear more from some of our guests, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Today in YGK is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What Will I Wear, 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
What'll I Wear offers the best in vintage funky one-of-a-kind treasures, clothing, accessories, and a fabulous selection of jewels, vintage and new. Find the cutest purse, the most dashing of hats and sunglasses, everything to complete your individual look. What'll I Wear has it all. They can dress you from top to bottom. Find your new fashion fave at What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street in Kingston. Visit their new location and follow them on Facebook to keep up to date with what's in store at What'll I Wear. Join CFRC at Kingston Writers Fest for At a Loss for Words with Carol Off on September 29th at 10:45 at the Screening Room. In a world where wokeness and fake news are thrown around as pejoratives, Carol Off offers her insight on how to mindfully traverse the current global political climate with the best vocabulary we have access to. Join her for a look inside her latest book, At a Loss for Words, which delves into the meaning of her six chosen words, freedom, democracy, truth, woke, choice, and taxes, unpacking the forces from right and left that have altered them beyond recognition. For more information, festival passes, and single event tickets, visit kingstonwritersfest.ca. The Kingston Music Office and CFRC 101.9 FM are pleased to present this week's Release Radar featuring local singer-songwriter Chris Giguere with their first single called Something New. Released last month, the track blends a little bit of blues, a little bit of rock and roll, marking a stylistic shift for Chris. With gritty guitar and soulful horns, this ode to a lifelong love affair will have you hooked from the first listen. You can also catch Chris Giguere live on stage on September 15th from 1 to 4 p.m. at McKinnon Brothers Brewing, and on September 20th from 8 to 11 p.m. at Musiki. Don't forget to follow Chris at Chris Giggs Music, the Kingston Music Office at visitkingston.music, and CFRC at CFRC Music on Instagram. Now, here's Something New by Chris Giguere.
There's something I've never done before. Something I've been meaning to try. I've been yearning for something more. I can't get started and I don't know why. Well, there's something I've been meaning to say. I'd say it with flowers if it was 1858. I know that's not the date. I'm waiting for the perfect time. The Eiffel Tower has been on my mind. You make me feel brave. I can't explain it. I wanna do something new with you. You save me from myself. Something new with you. Well, there's something I've been hoping for, but I'm afraid of my own desire. I keep my longer than we were apart. It's hard to see where you begin and where I start. Oh, like mine, but not much alike. Moving side by side, not always eye to eye. You make me feel brave. I can't explain it. I wanna do something.
Are you worried about the climate emergency and looking to do something about it? Join the Kingston Climate Justice Coalition for a special town hall event on Saturday, September 28th. Space is limited. Follow at Climate Coalition CA on Instagram and Facebook to register and learn more.
CFRC 101.9 FM has opened applications for its 2024-2025 Musicians in Residence program. Young and emerging artists are encouraged to apply to use CFRC studio space as an incubator to create new music, perform it live on air with video simulcast, take part in industry-related workshops for bands who are just starting out, and get paid. Learn more and apply today at cfrc.ca.
Kick your shoes off at the door.
This is CFRC 101.9 FM, your campus and community radio station, broadcast from the basement of Kerutas Hall, Queen's University, Kingston. You can also hear this program locally on Cogeco Cable, Channel 282, and is streamed online at cfrc.ca.
Welcome to Biotech Beat. This is your host, Chris Roth. Today we will hear a lecture on the topic, Age-Related Dementia. This program was produced and distributed by Southern Alberta Council on Public Affairs. Before that, a few messages.
Tree Canada's National Greening Program is planting seedlings across five regions of the country: BC, the Prairies, Ontario, Quebec, and the Atlantic. They plant in areas that are in need of reforestation or afforestation across Canada. Tree Canada selects sites where appropriate native species will be planted to make sure that natural forests come back to life. To learn more or to get involved, go to treecanada.ca.
I faced it. I have Alzheimer's disease.
My diagnosis has let me get on with my life my way.
The more we learned about my grandfather's dementia, the more we could face the future and make plans.
My husband, Tom, and I spoke to our doctor right away.
I have Alzheimer's, but it doesn't have me.
I faced it.
So can you.
For more information about early diagnosis, visit alzheimer.ca.
CFRC is active on every social media platform. Check us out at CFRC Radio on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok, and on Twitter at CFRC.
Let me introduce you to our speaker, who we are joyous to have with us today. It's Dr. Rob Sutherland, Professor of Neuroscience at the University of Lethbridge, and his talk is on how can we stem the tide of age-related dementia. Let's all welcome Rob.
Thanks very much, Beth. And So I appreciate the invitation to come and talk to this group. This is actually the third time I've talked to SACPA, the first time I've talked about age-related dementia. And the reason why I'm so interested in talking in the community about dementia is it's the most important health problem faced by Canada, the US, and Europe. And the reason why it is such an important problem is the fact that it's directly related to aging. The older a population becomes, the more the prevalence of dementias, specifically Alzheimer's disease. So my goal today is to point you to some of the current knowledge that we have about dementia. We know a great deal now. We didn't 20 years ago. And it is possible to reduce your risk for developing dementia by doing a few straightforward, simple things. And I'd like to talk about that. And those things will also be extremely important in containing costs to our healthcare system going forward. So a few facts that point to the scope of the problem. age-related dementia cases, with Alzheimer's disease being the most common, will double in about 20 years. So we have a lot of cases that we know of now. That's going to double, twice as many. And the healthcare costs will triple. And I don't notice any provincial governments around here that are getting ready for that. They're simply not. Right now, so ignoring 20 years from now, right now, dementias are more costly than heart disease and cancer combined. We now know that in the United Kingdom, which has had a mature dementia strategy for many, many years, we know it's the leading cause of death in the UK, ahead of cardiovascular disease and cancer. And I think that's true in Alberta and in the South Zone as well. We're just very far behind in record keeping. We haven't adopted best practices in data recording. It's important to recognize that brain aging is a spectrum. We have people who age very, very well and are sharp as a tack at 105. Not very many, but we have those people. And we have people who, when they reach their 40s, are showing age-related dementia. And we see everything in between. It's a very wide spectrum, and all parts of that spectrum are populated by us. Dementia isn't a disease, so it's a general term that captures a bunch of different diseases. And dementia refers to a cognitive impairment that's so severe that it interferes with daily life. So the person really can't live independently. At that point, we diagnose the person with dementia. 75% of the cases of dementia are Alzheimer's type dementia. So Alzheimer's disease is far and away the most common form of age-related dementia. Here's the list of common symptoms, and except for 7 and 8, the first 6 can show up as the primary or first symptom. It's not always memory problems, but memory problems are very commonly the first symptom. Often there are mood changes that occur early. Person starts showing more anxiety or depressive symptoms than they had during middle age. Personality changes can be early. Difficulty planning, showing behavioral flexibility, an inability to make decisions, this can be an early symptom. Eventually, most people lose the ability to perceive complex things, so they become impaired at recognizing faces or familiar places. And they have difficulty with emotional expression. Emotional expression becomes divorced from the actual emotional context. Eventually, people will show difficulty in hygiene and dressing, eating, drinking, and continence. So this is a fairly common sequence, but the first 6 can pop up as the first symptom, not always memory. Dementia is poorly diagnosed, and I'll say very poorly diagnosed in the South Zone. Often it's a family doctor who makes the diagnosis, and I notice many older people now don't see a family doctor. There's also diagnoses done by geriatricians, and geriatricians are specialists in care for the elderly. Should have a number of tests that are applied for making a diagnosis of dementia. Normally, people don't arrive at a geriatrician's office until they're already moderately demented, no longer able to live independently. And that's too late for many interventions. And then there's also memory clinics. We have one in Lethbridge over at the University of Lethbridge. And a registered psychologist designs the testing to evaluate in detail the level of cognitive performance or impairment. So I mentioned age is the biggest factor. One of the reasons why in parts of Asia and Africa, the rates of dementia are lower than here, has to do with the fact that we get very old. we have a high probability of being, you know, in our 80s, 90s, and more when we die. And if you look at this graph, especially at the 90 or 95 plus, it looks like about half of people will develop Alzheimer's type dementia if they live that long. And your risk in each decade of age increases rather dramatically. Another thing to note in this graph is that women are much more susceptible to Alzheimer's disease than men. And that's not due to the fact that they live longer. It's actually a susceptibility problem that is different between men and women. Here's an example of what a brain, Sonny over on the right, who died during pickleball with Alzheimer's disease. And there's a healthy brain. And part of what you notice is that at the end of life in Alzheimer's disease, the gaps between the ridges in the neocortex are very wide. And this turns out to be absolutely definitive for Alzheimer's disease. You don't need to go in and do a fancy neurochemical test or genetic test. Just the width of the sulci, those valleys, is sufficient to identify more than 90% of people with Alzheimer's disease. If you look inside the brain, you can see on the right that there's lots of brain tissue that's missing. So neuropathology, loss of neurons, is a cardinal symptom of age-related dementias, including Alzheimer's disease. But it's not the only one. The other cardinal symptoms are related to two proteins that can be measured in brain or in blood or in cerebrospinal fluid. And these are amyloid beta in the top left. And then in the bottom right, those long conical structures are not amyloid, they're pathological tau protein that form tangles inside neurons. And by the time you reach that point, that neuron would be functionally dead, if not completely moribund. We lose connections as well. So we have a buildup in two proteins, we lose neurons, and we also lose the fine connections between parts of the neocortex very gradually as the disease progresses. This is an extremely significant graph, and it shows why, for example, I said that by the time somebody arrives at a geriatrician's office, it's too late to do anything. Alzheimer's disease actually starts with amyloid beta, AB deposition, and it starts way, way before there's any symptoms. And it builds up almost to its maximum level when a person is showing very mild dementia, what we call mild cognitive impairment. So it's already maxed out at the point that somebody is showing mild cognitive impairment. Tau, pathological tau, starts building up much later, and it's quite likely that it's the real perpetrator of the harm to neurons. And by the time you end up with high levels of tau, you're moderately demented and simply can't look after yourself. Most of the work on new treatments has taken place where I have that little amyloid beta 42 immunization. Most of the attempt to measure the efficacy of treatments begins way, way too late. It needs to start over there before we actually have any evidence for cognitive impairment. And I'll have more to say about that in a little bit. So I want to talk about the risk factors over the lifespan, and I've divided up the risk factors into later life. So for most of us here, that's right now, later life. Orange is midlife, and blue is early life factors. And green, orange, and blue are modifiable risk factors. That is, we can intervene, or we ourselves can do something that will dramatically reduce the risk from each of these factors. The gray ones that I'm going to show you are potentially unmodifiable. So these are things that are there very, very early. And it's looking like some of the risk factors interact with age, but I'll leave that alone for now. So let's talk about old age risk factors. And about 15% of the overall risk of Alzheimer's disease depends upon risk factors present in old age. Smoking, clinical depression, physical or cognitive inactivity, hypertension, untreated, diabetes, not properly controlled, and brain injury, traumatic brain injuries. So if you were, when you hit age 62, to not smoke, treat any depression, remain physically active summer and winter, control any hypertension, control any diabetic symptoms, and avoid traumatic brain injury in old age, so don't fall on the ice, you can reduce your overall risk by about 15%. The total amount of modifiable risk is about 35%. So the majority of the risk is actually earlier than old age. So it's too late, really, to have a big, big impact. You can have an effect on 15%. Midlife is about 12%. And here, I understand that your last speaker talked about hearing loss. Hearing loss, we don't have as much data on hearing loss as we do for some of the other factors, but the data we do have really speak to the importance of correcting any hearing loss in middle age. Too late for most of us now to begin to correct it. It needs to be corrected when you're in your 40s and 50s. Again, hypertension shows up in middle age. Obesity shows up as a risk factor in middle age. Cognitive and physical inactivity, sleep problems, and again, traumatic brain injury. So if you were perfect as a middle ager in regard to these factors, you could reduce your risk by about 12%. Early life only accounts for about 8% of the risk factor. The most significant one here, statistically, is low educational attainment. And it seems to be a continuous variable. The less education, formal education you have, the higher is your risk of Alzheimer's disease. And completing high school, completing post-secondary education, and getting an advanced degree, all of these things reduce the overall risk that's contained in the education category. And in education, I include multilingualism. So learning second, third languages are also very important in regard to this risk. Traumatic brain injury, cognitive and physical inactivity. And, you know, a couple of generations ago, we didn't have very many children who were physically inactive, but we do now. The potentially unmodifiable risk factors account for about 65% of the overall risk of Alzheimer's disease. And these, most of them, are gene variants. There's also some epigenetic factors that aren't directly inherited that modify the expression of good genes and make them have less beneficial effect. One of the most important genes is APOE4. That gene is involved in metabolizing fats, lipids, and transporting lipids in the brain. And that one gene alone can account for 7% of the risk. And we're learning quite a lot about APOE4 right now. Some of the new treatments that are being evaluated preclinically are targeting lipid metabolism and lipid transport in the brain. And some of those are looking promising. But if we think that there's only one Alzheimer's gene, we're wrong. There's 43 others. And each time I give a talk, or each year that I give a talk, the number of identified genes goes up. And this is the majority of the risk for Alzheimer's disease. Here are clusters of the genes that we talk about. The top left, we have almost certain Alzheimer's disease if you have any of those gene variants, and there's three of them. If you go down towards the right, there's a lower probability of developing Alzheimer's disease. And if you have two of these bad APOE4 alleles, very unlucky, you have a very high risk of Alzheimer's disease. And then we get down to the more common variants. They actually bring with them very little overall risk, each one of them. But if you sum all these up, you end up with what's known as a polygenic risk score for Alzheimer's disease. So if you want now, for a few hundred dollars, you can find out exactly what your polygenic risk is. How many of you would do that? Okay, the rest of you would rather not know. James Watson, who was co-discoverer of the structure of DNA, he had his genome done, and he refused to be told what any of the risk factors are at any of these gene loci. Did not want to know. So you're in good company. Or actually, maybe bad company. I don't know. Okay, so the good news is that these clusters of genes that we can't really do anything about right now fall into four groupings. There are genes that are related to amyloid, beta amyloid, the pathological form, and these are the focus of the antibody therapies that are available right now. So there's two that have been approved in the U.S. So far, I think still only one is available in Canada. And that little graph I showed you about when amyloid beta starts building up, when should the immunization against amyloid beta be? Yeah, as early as possible. As early as possible. Not when you're showing symptoms of dementia. Tau. We now have lots of antibody therapies that are being evaluated preclinically for pathological tau. Right at the moment, they don't look as promising, actually, as the amyloid antibody therapies, but they're newer on the research scene. There are drugs that are being developed to modify lipid metabolism and transport of fats in the brain. Our innate immunity system seems to go horribly wrong in Alzheimer's disease. The microglia, which are the single cell most important for innate immunity in the brain, start treating some fragments of neurons that have been damaged by proteins, start gobbling them up and contributing to the loss of neurons. And there was a really cool study that was just published yesterday that found 12 brains, this was a study done in the Netherlands, of people who died quite old and who had clear Alzheimer's pathology in terms of amyloid beta and pathological tau, but they had no dementia at all, despite the fact that they were in their 90s. And the one thing that was pretty clear is they had wimpy microglia. The microglia they had were not aggressively gobbling things up. They were just relaxed, sitting around. And so that may actually be a good target in the future. And then the final cluster are genes that are involved in endocytosis. That's the gobbling up of debris and pathological material by cells, usually microglia. Okay. There are lots of other smaller risks. Probably the one that is not discussed nearly enough is socioeconomic status. That can really modulate risk of other factors. Multilingualism is protective, and some version of the Mediterranean diet, and there's now many versions of the Mediterranean diet, very low in red meat, lots of seafood, olive oil, not dairy fats, and so on. Good sleep hygiene is protective. Avoiding heavy drinking and avoiding abstaining entirely seem to be protective. And it seems like all vaccinations, including the annual flu vaccine is protective. So the more consistent someone has been throughout their life in receiving vaccinations, the lower the risk of Alzheimer's disease. And we seem to be going backwards on that one in Alberta. Migraine with aura increases risk of Alzheimer's disease. There's a little bit of pathological events that occur during a migraine aura. And air and noise pollution increase risk. So people who live near busy roadways and so on, or downtown. Current treatments, in the last couple of minutes, I'll say something about this. Cholinesterase inhibitors are general cognitive enhancers. They don't have anything specific to do in relation to Alzheimer's pathology. NMDA blockers, memantine is the main one, do tend to reduce the amount of neuronal damage that's taking place. And so a combination of cholinesterase inhibitors and memantine is a very good idea early in dementia, all the way through to moderate dementia, and it should increase the quality of life for most people if both of those are done. And you'll be happy to know that Alberta Health Services South Zone has the lowest rate of prescribing these two kinds of treatments. Physicians don't do it. Alberta's low, and this is the lowest place in Canada. People are not getting the medications that we know produce some benefit. In the US, I mentioned two antibodies. These remove amyloid. They're probably moderately impactful early in the dementia process, not so much later. And I think really the future is going to be a combination of modifying all of the modifiable risk factors that you can, and there'll be a cocktail of different drugs, at least in the initial phase of effective treatment, that involve targeting the five areas where genes are causing trouble in the progression of Alzheimer's disease. Okay, with some summing up, with what we know right now, we can prevent a third of the cases of Alzheimer's disease. And I don't know why any enlightened health service wouldn't want to get out there and ambitiously pursue these preventative steps that are pretty straightforward and easy. I think we also should give people a break who are elderly and starting to show symptoms. Most of the risk that they have experienced over their life, they can't do anything about. It's not like they can bend that curve when they hit age 75. They can only have a modest effect on that. And so it really is not a matter of individual responsibility, I don't think. And the effective treatments are going to require significant investments in research. Dementia research receives far less than the treatment of cardiovascular disease or cancer receive, despite it costing the health system far more. And I guess I'll just mention one more thing. We're the only province where the province does not invest in an Alzheimer's Society. Every other province in Canada, the government supports the Alzheimer's Society. This is the main contact point where people learn who they can consult about diagnosis and treatments, where they learn about the sequence of services that are available as a person becomes more severely affected. And our province doesn't support it. They do have a dementia strategy in the province of Alberta. It was put in place in 2017, 7 years ago. There was a progress report published late 2018, and then something changed in 2019. And there hasn't been a single thing done since then. Nothing. Despite the fact that there's some hard-won facts about how to reduce our overall risk. And I think I'll stop there and invite questions.
Hi, Rob. Henning Mundel is my name, and thank you very much, and I'm so glad that it... I have two questions for you. One is, you mentioned, you showed a graph where the progress towards Alzheimer's is quite a bit higher for women than men.
Probably there's no sex difference in the susceptibility genes in Alzheimer's disease. It's not probably a gene expression difference between the sexes. What it seems to be related to, I think, two things. One is that...
That's it, folks. Tune in for another round of Biotech Beat, same time next week.
What you listening to, son?
I don't think you like it.
Well, why not? I like this new generation of music.
What the...